from deep inside your radio.
Ladies and gentlemen, I've been remiss in welcoming new stations to the ever-existing LeShow Network, KFCF-FM. Enough Fs for you? Just a handful of Fs. KFCF-FM in Fresno. Welcome aboard. And we're also airing now on KPOV in Bend, Oregon. No jokes. Bend, Oregon, ladies and gentlemen, for your listening pleasure. And the situation with FEMA and New Orleans and the whole and the Corps of Engineers just gets better and better. Senator Mary Landrieu this week expressed concern that the FEMA people had delayed in finishing a disaster housing plan that they were just required to complete by an act of Congress. But, you know, that's just a law. And the grown-ups really don't really believe in law, do they? She says it may not be much better prepared to house victims of the next major disaster than it was for the last one. The FEMA draft report includes blank spaces in which the agency was supposed to respond to seven issues specified by Congress, including plans for housing disaster victims close to their jobs and accommodating people with disabilities. Oh, well, they can figure that out for themselves. Someone either instructed or suggested that some of the details not be filled in because it might cost something, Senator Landrieu speculated. Harvey Johnson said, who was a deputy administrator of FEMA, says the report, which was due, last year, is taking longer to put together than he and other agency officials anticipated. He says the delay is not caused by budget restraints, but a desire to respond appropriately to the complex policy issues. See, we could have done it badly and bitten on time. Kids, this is the way to talk to your teachers. I could have done it on time, but it wouldn't have been good. Yeah, what kind of example are we giving for our children? I remember that question from the last decade. The draft report, short of the details Congress demanded, provides a foundation to enable the agency to work with other agencies, according to Johnson. When will the final disaster housing report be completed? Johnson said it should be done this fall, wouldn't offer a specific date, saying he's gun-shy after those other time projections were missed by FEMA. Why does the agency still plan to use trailers during major disasters? Johnson was asked. He said they would be used if necessary for no more than 6 months and under strict standards for formaldehyde levels. All right, then. We'll be keeping track of that. Of course, we won't be measuring those levels until much later. You know, for your listening pleasure. And, ladies and gentlemen, the United States Army Corps of Engineers, upon whom New Orleans depends for the safety of its people, is, quote, scrambling, according to the New Orleans Times-Picayune, to get additional protection in place along 1,800 feet of a flood wall which already collapsed last time around, and which must be seriously reinforced before the next thing, according to new info, new geotechnical analysis. The flood wall's ability to handle high water had been seriously overestimated by the Army Corps of Engineers, primarily because some bad figures were used in the stability assessments done shortly after Katrina. Oh, you're not supposed to use the bad figures. I see. We didn't get that memo. The new numbers, according to the Times-Picayune, paint a much different, much starker picture of the wall's ability to stand up to another storm surge. It's way too close for comfort, says the Corps' hurricane protection officer. He said the original stability analysis done in the weeks after Katrina used ground elevation figures taken from the original flood wall design plans. Those figures were off by as much as 3 to 4 feet. And by the way, those figures were off originally, We used the wrong ones again to fix it with. You don't like that? Give us more money. Hello, welcome to the show. From the edge of America, from the home of the homeless, I'm Harry Shearer, welcoming you to this edition of the show. Ladies and gentlemen, television stations near the Texas-Mexico border don't have to shut off their analog signals. After next year's switch to digital television, according to a bill passed this week by the Senate of the United States. You see, these folks are going to be watching Mexican stations, so the theory goes. They're broadcasting in analog. So, according to the sponsor of the bill, viewers relying on Mexican programming will be at risk of missing emergency and amber alert messages. The bill would allow stations within 50 miles of the Mexican border to continue broadcasting in analog for 4 years. The premise being, because they're watching analog television in Mexico, they need to watch American analog television, you see. So let's all move to within 50 miles of the border. So we don't have to mess. I think it would be cheaper than the alternative, messing with all this digital crap. But, you know, that's just me. Oh, it is just me. Anyway, that's cute, isn't it? But now, ladies and gentlemen, even cuter, news from outside the bubble. By the way, the computer floating in the ocean is mine. Don't rescue it. A large bag with bomb written across it, passed through Qantas check-in and security screening for oversized baggage at Brisbane or airport this week, according to the Australian newspaper owned by Rupert Murdoch. Baggage handlers preparing to transfer the bag raised the alarm and stopped work for about 40 minutes. Security staff and managers attempted to remove it. However, the situation deteriorated, according to a union spokesman, when managers dragged the still unscreened bag towards a more populated area of the airport. It was the latest in a string of security scares at Brisbane Airport, in which weapons, including guns and knives, have passed through security scanners without being detected. A Qantas spokeswoman confirmed a bag with, quote, inappropriate language, end quote, caused an incident at the airport, but refused to answer any questions. She refused to say if there were any delays, and when asked how a bag marked bomb could get checked in by staff, she said, "That's the extent of our comment. Sorry." There's news of apes outside the bubble. An initiative to help stop orangutans being driven into extinction has put the price of saving them at about $1,000 per orang. Conservationists are attempting to save vital areas of forest from destruction by buying them from loggers and farmers to ensure the apes have enough habitat to survive, according to the Rupert Murdoch-owned Times of London. In the first stage of a scheme to buy and preserve thousands of acres of tropical forest in Borneo, conservationists have identified a 220-acre plot that links two protected reserves, supporting 600 orangs. They're under so much pressure from habitat loss, they face virtual extinction in the wild with only a few small groups left. They suffer a double whammy from deforestation because the loss of trees deprives them of territory, while the fragmentation of wooded areas limits their ability to travel to meet new mates. Babe, I remember that. And find fresh sources of food. But now a campaign has begun to buy thousands of acres of forest from farmers and loggers before they can be chopped down. Also, apes and beyond the bubble, chimpanzees, according to the British newspaper The Independent, chimpanzees subjected to medical experiments suffer similar psychiatric symptoms to those shown by tortured humans. An assessment of the behavior of 116 chimpanzees who've been involved in animal research found that 95% display at least one of the distinctive patterns of behavior that people show when suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder. The chimps under study now live in a private sanctuary in the United States. Their unusual behavior is still causing concern years after they were released from the animal research laboratories in which they were experimented upon. This information will be discussed at an international primate conference in Edinburgh this week, used to press for a Europe-wide ban on the use of great apes in medical research. It's obvious these chimps are suffering chronically, says Hope Ferdosian, an American doctor who has treated torture patients from around the world. Really? You mean like severe organ damage or death? Because otherwise it's not like torture. Sorry. Sorry, chimps. And finally, from the Asia Times, you know, we have to get modern about this torture thing. Now, finally, from the Asia Times, from Michael Scheuer, who was head of CIA's task force to capture Osama bin Laden for a while. Now he writes, in recent weeks, Pakistani, Arab, and Western journalists have reported that non-Afghan Muslims from Europe and North America included are flocking to Afghanistan in part because some are moving from Iraq, mostly because there's a widespread perception among Islamists that the West is on the ropes in Afghanistan. The suicide bomber that attacked the Danish embassy in Kabul arrived from Saudi Arabia. Pakistani media say there are now 8,000 foreign fighters in the tribal area of Pakistan. The ongoing revitalization of the Taliban-led insurgency in Afghanistan has grown to the point that the two additional U.S. brigades promised by both Obama and McCain are likely to make little or no difference. This is from Michael Scheuer, who ran the Osama bin Laden, let's capture him, task force at the CIA, till they didn't capture him. He continues to write, "The Afghan situation is certain to get worse before additional NATO troops arrive because of the growing anger of Pakistanis over U.S. airstrikes in the tribal areas and the growing unity and anti-U.S. NATO attitudes among the Pashtun tribes on both sides of the Afghan-Pakistan border." That attitude fomented by U.S. air attacks. Well, that's good news from outside the bubble. But let's probe this Pakistan situation a little further, ladies and gentlemen, if we may, while the fans hum noisily in the background. In a while, when the show originates from New Orleans, poor old New Orleans, the air conditioning works. Here in rich old Santa Monica, please give, won't you? Because these fans obviously need oiling now. So the week began with the New York Times reporting that the CIA has now confronted Pakistan about the ties between Pakistan's powerful spy service, the ISI, and militias, militants, guerrillas, insurgents, evildoers in the tribal areas. The week ended with the Washington Post reporting that elements of that intelligence service in Pakistan actually provided logistical support to the militants who staged last month's car bombing at the Indian embassy in Kabul. The information based on communication intercepts has dramatically heightened U.S. concerns about longstanding, ladies and gentlemen, mentioned here in 2001. Don't you know? Longstanding ties between Pakistan's Inter-Services Intelligence Agency, the ISI, and Taliban-allied groups that are battling U.S. forces in Afghanistan. Supposedly, this is because Pakistan, which really cares a lot more about India than it does about Afghanistan, sees the Taliban as useful to help them train guerrillas to fight the Indians in Kashmir, among other things. But now, this weekend, Pakistan has promised to weed out those elements sympathetic to the Taliban. Though Pakistan, this is from the British newspaper, The Guardian, though Pakistani officials publicly deny there's any link to the suicide bombing in Kabul, they privately confirm, privately, that they, too, think elements within their own intelligence agency, the ISI, were involved in the car bombing of the Indian embassy in Kabul. Nice. Nice people doing nice things. A spokesperson for the Pakistan government says individuals in the ISI are probably acting on their own, just like AQ Khan. Boy, there's a lot of freedom in Pakistan. A lot of people in the government acting on their own. That's the real freedom. And going against official policy, adding the authorities need to identify these people and weed them out. Just get a weed whacker. Santa Monica has plenty. And they run on gasoline. That's right, we're paying the Saudis to get rid of our weeds. The Australian newspaper, The Age, says, as well, there are probably Taliban sympathizers within the ranks of the intelligence establishment. And Hamid Karzai, the president of Afghanistan, this weekend, says terrorists are increasing their influence in Pakistan and are receiving institutional nurturing and support. It is this embedded nature of terrorists that make it a much more sinister threat, he says. Our friends in Pakistan, ladies and gentlemen. I wonder if there's analog television along the Pakistan-Afghanistan border. That would be sweet. That would be sweet. And this guy, I think this is the more interesting area to delve into right now. There are two different views made public this week of how you deal with terrorism. First comes the RAND Corporation, that hotbed of Francophiles, saying the Bush administration's terrorism fighting strategy has not significantly undermined al-Qaeda's capabilities. It says the struggle against terrorism is better waged by law enforcement than by armies. Yeah, John Kerry got kind of whacked for saying the same thing 4 years ago, but he looked French. This study by the RAND Corporation also contends the administration committed a fundamental error in portraying the conflict with al-Qaeda as a war on terrorism. The phrase falsely suggests there can be a battlefield solution to terrorism and symbolically conveys warrior status on terrorists. Terrorists should be perceived and described as criminals, not holy warriors, say authors Seth Jones and Martin Libicki. The authors contend, authors have based their report on analysis of more than 600 terrorist movements tracked over decades by RAND. I think it was pointed out in this very broadcast that the Indonesians are trying to, and having some success in wrapping up their JI terrorist homegrown Islamic militants by using the cops. The researchers found that the RAND found that more than 40% of terrorist movements fade away when their political objectives are met, but that's only when they're secular and have narrow goals. By contrast, al-Qaeda's religious and political agenda calls for nothing less than the overthrow of secular Arab governments. A roughly equal number of terrorist groups die when their key leaders are arrested or killed. In the vast majority of instances, according to this report, that is accomplished by local law enforcement. So get the LAPD looking for bin Laden. In most cases, says Jones, a terrorism expert and the report's lead author, military force isn't the best instrument. That's view number one. View number two, Robert Gates, Secretary of Defense, says even winning the conflicts in Iraq and Afghanistan will not end the long war against al-Qaeda and other terrorists, and that should be the nation's top military priority over the coming decades. That's according to his new national defense strategy. Lessons learned, babe. The strategy document calls for the military to master irregular warfare rather than focusing on conventional conflicts against other nations. This is a culmination of Gates' work since he took over the Pentagon in late 2006. So he's been doing a lot of reading, but apparently not what the RAND Corporation writes. That's okay. You can't read everything. And now, ladies and gentlemen, news of the warm. Especially you can't read everything in your bailiwick when it's a large bailiwick.
Soft, listen to the warm.
A new study confirms that coral reefs could become yet another casualty of climate change if something is not done to cool the warming globe. The reason? Marine cements that bind together reefs can't form in waters full of dissolved carbon dioxide. Scientists have long believed that preventing or dousing forest fires helps combat global warming by saving trees and thus allowing forests to take up more carbon dioxide from the atmosphere. But surprising new data on hundreds of California forest sites suggests the opposite. The work could help quantify the role of forests in the global carbon cycle. Lightning-caused fires serve a natural mechanism within forests. They destroy small trees and underbrush while often allowing large trees to remain standing and flourish. Since the beginning of the last century, U.S. forest managers have sought to fight as many small forest fires as possible. That policy has allowed more shrubs and small trees to grow than in the past. The increasing quantity of vegetation, scientists calculated recently, sucks 50 million metric tons of carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere each year, roughly 14% of the carbon pulled in by U.S. forests. However, historical data on tree size weren't available to allow scientists to confirm that the forest had absorbed that much carbon over the last century. Now I'm confused. The scientists conclude that the large trees had to compete with the growing population of small trees, making the big trees more susceptible to drought, wind, and insect attack than they would have been without the crowding. Because the large trees died, they didn't absorb as much carbon dioxide. It's counterintuitive, says one of the researchers. Okay, We figured it out. Birds have been moving north in Europe over the past 25 years because of climate change and the vanguard of likely huge shifts in the ranges of plants and animals. Scientists said this week a study of 42 rare bird species in Britain showed that southern European bird species, such as the Dartford warbler, the Searle bunting, the little egret, or Setti's warbler had become more common in Britain. Species usually found in northern Europe had become less frequent in Britain. And Tasmanian scientists way down under are concerned a microscopic marine snail species found in the southern ocean may soon die out due to climate change. The scientists say it is field evidence that sea life in the southern ocean is being affected by warmer water. Small snail shells have been analyzed in the laboratory, and scientists have found the snails have dropped half their shell weight over the past decade, evidence that climate change is affecting sea life in the southern ocean. News of the warm, ladies and gentlemen. A copyrighted feature of this broadcast. This is the show, and apropos of jobs they never told you you could have at Career Day, one notices Radovan Karadzic, who went on trial this week, or made his first appearance at the International Court of Justice at The Hague, keeping track so far, mass murderer, alternative healer, and now lawyer representing himself. That, my friends, is a career. And now, speaking of justice...
Harry Shearer, I'm going to get you.
Uh-oh. Katie Couric sneaked in here. Katie? Katie, you're not going to get me. I'm going to get me before you do. But now...
But I found a driver, and that's a stop. Baby, you can drive my car.
The first military commission trial of the worst of the worst, the trial of Hamdan... the driver of Osama bin Laden, keeps making history in American law. Makes you proud. Makes you stand tall when you realize this is the justice that we're offering. the charges against him, the status that he's given as a war criminal, are based on the fact that, or the assertion that the United States is at war with Al-Qaeda. But most of the actual behavior he's charged with, driving bin Laden around Afghanistan, occurred before 9/11. So apparently we were at war with Al-Qaeda before they attacked us. And not on 9/11, of course, they've attacked us other places. But we weren't. And the judge in the case said at the beginning of the week that he would look askance at the testimony of an interrogator who interrogated Hamdan, because the presumption, according to the judge, was that the interrogation was coercive. I don't know where he got that idea, reading those damn papers. So he said the government had an affirmative obligation to prove that the interrogation wasn't coercive. By Wednesday, although the government had presented no such evidence, he allowed the testimony. But he explained in a 5-page opinion, almost all of which was blacked out. American justice, ladies and gentlemen, makes you proud. And now,
he's not a general. He commands no troops. He's not an inspector. He peeks at no stoops. He's an inspector general.
News from the inspectors general. The U.S. government paid a California contractor $142 million to build prisons, fire stations, and police facilities in Iraq that were never built or finished, according to the Special Inspector General for Iraq. Parsons of Pasadena received the money, but only completed about one-third of its projects, which also included courthouses and border control stations. They don't need those. The Inspector General's office is expected to release 2 detailed audits this week, evaluating Parsons' work on the contract. Far less was accomplished under this contract than originally planned, the Inspector General wrote. Millions of dollars in waste are likely associated with incomplete, terminated, and abandoned projects under this contract. Parsons said it had some serious reservations about the conclusions in the audit. Parsons' work is emblematic of other troubles in the $50 billion U.S. reconstruction effort, in which there have been widespread problems of contractors doing poor work. Hey, it's work. Being late and overspending on projects. These issues, combined with bad record-keeping, lack of oversight by overworked government managers, and high personnel turnover for both the government and contractors in an unstable war zone, that has created millions of dollars in waste, according to the Iraq Inspector General. Aside from that, Mrs. Lincoln, how do you like the war? The Homeland Security Department still has problems handling classified top-secret intelligence information, according to a new report from its department, Office of Inspector General. Overall, its Office of Intelligence and Analysis has made progress in managing intelligence systems, but there are still unaddressed problems, the IG concluded. Although the report has been redacted, so... Blackwater misrepresented the size of its own self, the firm, so it could receive more than $100 million in small business contracts.
We're just small. We're just Blackwater over here in the little small place.
This is according to the Inspector General of the Small Business Administration. He said the outfit obtained a total of 39 contracts intended for small businesses with annual revenues of $6.5 million or less between 2005 in 2007, but the report said Blackwater's revenue surpassed $200 million for those years. The report also found that it is possible that misrepresentations took place on remaining 6 contracts, but it did say the small business contracts could have involved potential misrepresentations by Blackwater. It referred the matter to investigators at the Departments of Defense and Veteran Affairs. Despite persistent fears of mad cow disease in Canadian beef, the Department of Agriculture has failed to properly track hundreds of Canadian cattle coming to the United States, according to the Agriculture Department's Inspector General. This audit was completed in March, but only recently made public. Relax, it's mad cow. It said some of the imported cattle did not have proper identification or health records, despite federal regulations requiring them. It's just way the other Canadians come over here, isn't it? Am I? The audit did not say how many cattle were improperly brought into the United States. Inspector General spokesman said auditors are not sure of the number because of a lack of records. Well, that's the way to do it. The Environmental Protection Agency is warning its pollution enforcement officials not to talk directly to the agency's own inspector general or to congressional investigators or reporters, according to an internal email. If you're contacted directly by the IG's office requesting information of any kind, please do not respond to questions or make any statements, says Robbie Farrell, the chief of staff from the EPA. That's good work, Robbie. And for nearly 2 years, a young political aide sought to cultivate a farm system for Republicans at the Justice Department, hiring scores of prosecutors and immigration judges who espoused conservative priorities and Christian lifestyle choices. This, of course, made the news this week. The aide, Monica Goodling, exercised what amounted to veto power over a wide range of critical jobs, asking candidates for their views on abortion and same-sex marriage, and maneuvering around senior officials who outranked her, including the department's second-in-command. The extensive report by the Justice Department's Office of the Inspector General concluded that Goodling and others had broken civil service laws, run afoul of department policy, and engaged in misconduct. You remember her. Goodling declined to cooperate with investigators because she had nothing to hide. Former Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez told investigators he was unaware of the illegal hiring practices his aides were using. It's simply not possible for any cabinet officer to be completely aware of and micromanage the activities of staffers, particularly when they don't inform him of what's going on, said his lawyer. Gonzalez's statements to Congress last year about the firings of 9 U.S. attorneys and other subjects remain under investigation by the Inspector General.
I was loyal to George Bush whenever he'd call, even if he wanted nothing at all. I was loyal on the rise, I was loyal on the fall, 'cause even I know what the point of the fall is. Give the critics the head of Alberto Gonzalez.
Gonzalez.
The Geneva Conventions I helped redefine, calling them quaint, I think that quote was mine. 'Cause certain detainees were just over the line, in a room with top lawyers, it's clear where the gall is. In the legalese head of Alberto Gonzalez.
Gonzalez.
The first Hispanic was a badge I'd wear with pride. It got me upstairs and it got me inside. In Texas, George Bush named me to his Supreme Court. Could the big one be next? I'd sure need his support. So my advice was the most approving sort. If I wanted the robe, I'd give nothing but solace and let Bush be the head of Alberto Gonzalez. Wanted to change prosecutors for friends. A big Senate hearing is where that trail ends. The truth doesn't break, but it certainly bends. I give a display of what total lack of recall is. Just a memory hole in the head of Alberto Gonzalez. The first Hispanic was a badge I'd wear with pride. It got me upstairs and it got me inside. I'll spend time with my family. I'll spend time alone. I'll sit by my computer. I'll sit by my phone, hoping that my old friend will just throw me a bone. Even though I know how unlikely that call is, so I'll take back the head of Alberto Gonzalez.
Yeah, that's from Songs of the Bushmen. I know. For those of you listening to my home station, it may come as news that record exists. Ladies and gentlemen, this week, President Bush and his dad, the other President Bush, called Rush Limbaugh to wish him a happy 20th anniversary on the air. And they called him on the air. They were at Kennebunkport, hanging. President Bush, the current one, said they were about to have lunch but decided to call right before. And they apparently surprised Rush Limbaugh. He sounded surprised on the air. When President George W. Bush handed the phone over to George H.W. Bush, the senior Bush gave Rush Limbaugh some advice on his golf swing and then said, quote, "Have you seen our man Ailes lately?" And Limbaugh sounded a bit taken aback by that, then said, "Yeah, I saw him at Tony Snow's funeral," referring to Roger Ailes, head of Fox News. Then President George H.W. Bush said, "Oh, are we on the air? I better clean up my act." And Limbaugh said, yeah, we're on the radio. Of course, that was the end of what America heard. What followed was lunch at Kennebunkport.
Mm. Yeah, grab yourself some of those razor clams, 43, before the sun gets to them. You know, for about the 700th time, 41, I'm not that much of a clam person.
No.
Unless they're dipped in batter, deep fried, and then, you know, I'd usually just eat the coating and throw the clams away, but I do enjoy the kind of, you know, subtle clam flavor on the coating.
Uh-huh. Okay, we'll save some for Jebby. Uh-huh. He should be off the phone soon.
Yeah, I sure don't envy Big Brother trying to sell Florida land right now, especially to Rush.
Well, who else do you think is going to pay top dollar? Besides, Jebby's not selling land. He's getting Rush in on a plan to, as far as I know, build a state-of-the-art broadcast facility for radio talk show hosts in South Florida. Something called Talk City.
Uh-huh.
Could be huge. You know, you got to be cooped up in a little studio 3 hours a day. Why wouldn't you want to be in Florida the rest of the time?
Yeah, I guess.
You got a tax break for it through the legislature.
Mm-hmm.
That's a big part of the deal.
Shoot, 41, that's probably the whole deal.
Yeah.
You know, if I'd figured out a way to get a tax break for the damn Texas Rangers, mm-hmm. I'd probably still be in baseball.
Yeah, well, then you wouldn't have to be protecting your boy Genius from having to testify to Congress.
Oh, hey, look at here. The principle of the privileged executive is an accepted part of federal Jewish prudence. I mean, you know, Carl doesn't want to testify any more than we want him to.
Mm-hmm. You sure of that?
Oh, it's just a Congress. It's not like he's up against anybody with real cojones.
Yeah. That's a good point. Federal prosecutors, on the other hand, they've got an interesting little talent for flipping potential witnesses in cases like this. Just ask Cap Weinberger.
Not our federal prosecutors.
Mm-hmm.
See, ever since Alberto, they have all been included in our primary accountability strategization. Chainster likes to call it Operation Bad Apples.
Mm-hmm. familiar with the general outlines.
Yeah.
Still, we'd hate to be dependent on Carl now that he's part of the media.
Now, 41, that's 20th century thinking. See, Carl's not part of the media. They're part of him.
He's working as an analyst for Our Man Ales.
Yeah, by the way, smooth move saying that on the air. Well, Our Man.
Yeah.
Makes it sound like he's, you know, I don't know, like he's our man.
Well, first, before you hand me the phone, be nice to tell your old man that it's live on the radio.
You think with all I got on my plate right now, trying to maintain exercise and sleep discipline, that I'm going to spend 10 minutes talking to Rush Limbaugh off the air?
Don't think anybody thought our man meant anything, but, you know, that fellow that we like.
Yeah, well, Carl says Roger Ailes is talking about giving him a radio show first next year.
Oh, don't tell me. Tell Jebby. Carl might want to buy into Talk City.
Yeah.
By the way, you worked out with McCain what you're doing at the convention?
No, we're still in the kind of Mexican stand-up. See, here's what I think about that whole McCain deal. Even after we sent over three of our top political people, they still don't seem committed to going for the jugular vein.
I've been a little more on the attack last couple of weeks, haven't they?
Comparing Obama to Britney Spears, you call that an attack?
Well,
they attack like, I don't know, like Democrats.
Somebody put the Wall Street Journal up to attacking Obama for being too thin.
Hey, in case you haven't noticed, 41, I'm about the best conditioned president in the United States since I don't know who.
I was kind of a slender president.
Well, okay, there you go. So what's the point of attacking him for not being fat?
I think it was a little more dog whistle than that, Sprout. Yeah, saying he's not overweight. Just another way of saying he's not one of us. Same thing with the Britney ad. I think they're actually pretty on message over there.
Well, anywho, they're talking about scheduling my appearance as far as the eye can see away from McCain's acceptance speech as possible.
Meaning?
Well, right now, they want me to speak on a Sunday night.
But convention doesn't open till the Monday.
Oh, I know it. It's a real Rubio's Cube they're working with over there. Because, see, Monday night is diversity night, so it's all the women and the diversity type people. Tuesday night is congressional candidates. If I show up that night, those folks will fly to Cuba before they go to the convention. No,
Wednesday is the vice president deal.
Yeah. And see, in the meantime, our shop produced an ad with Obama speaking Arabic. They tell me it's the same technique that they technicize to make dogs and babies look like they're actually talking. And man, it's powerful. You see that dude speaking Arabic, and it's no way can do, Jose. And what do the McCain people do with it?
Need a little more lobster sauce with my lobster here. Pass it over, will you, Sprout?
Yeah. They have a bunch of meetings about it, you know. Time's a-ticking, fellas.
Not really your problem.
Yeah, something you might not understand, 41. Unlike certain ex-presidents at this picnic table, I have a legacy to protect.
Really need more lobster sauce now.
Okay, here you go.
Still, good to talk to Rush.
Oh, yeah. Great to talk to Rush.
And now, ladies and gentlemen. The apologies of the week. That was just a moment of thinking, wasn't it?
We're so sorry.
Did you think during that moment? I know I did. The House of Representatives this week apologized to black Americans more than 140 years after slavery was abolished for the, quote, fundamental injustice, cruelty, brutality, and inhumanity of slavery and Jim Crow segregation. The resolution passed on a voice vote late in the day, was sponsored by Representative Steve Cohen,
a white Jew who represents a majority black district in Memphis, who unsuccessfully tried to join the Congressional Black Caucus this year. I hope this is a part of a beginning of a dialogue that this country needs to engage in concerning what the effects of slavery and Jim Crow have been, Cohen said. I think we started it, and we're going to continue. Senator Tom Harkin, Democrat of Iowa, is considering introducing a companion measure in the Senate. Well, take your time, babe. Slavery's not getting any younger. The U.S. military acknowledged this week that American soldiers killed three law-abiding Iraqi citizens last month as the Iraqis traveled to their jobs at the Baghdad airport. The military had initially said the soldiers acted in self-defense after being fired upon by criminals. In fact, no weapons were found in the civilian's car, the military said, adding that an investigation concluded neither the soldiers nor the civilians were to blame for the accident. This was an extremely unfortunate and tragic incident, said Army Colonel Alan W. Batchelet. Our deepest regrets of sympathy and condolences go out to the family. Nobody's to blame. That's accountability with a capital Yuch. The yeshiva student who pried Barack Obama's prayer, identified only by the first initial of his name, Aleph, and with his face obscure... Oh, sorry. You know this story? When Barack Obama went to the Western Wall in Jerusalem, there's a tradition of putting a little prayer in between the stones. Barack Obama did that. This yeshiva student took the prayer out, identified only by his first initial, Aleph, and with his face obscured, went on Channel 2 television in Israel to confess he took the note and passed it to the press. It drew international criticism, including from leading rabbis who said Jewish morality had been compromised by the publication of the prayer. I'm sorry, said Aleph. It was kind of a prank. I hope he wasn't hurt. Deadline, Washington. No, we already did that. Oh, no, the rabbi overseeing the Western Wall, Shmuel Rabinowitz, sent a letter to Obama in which he expressed his sorrow over the removal of the note. So, everybody's apologized now for removal of that prayer. ABC's Martin Bashir is apologizing for a tasteless remark he made while keynoting an event at the Unity Conference in Chicago last week. Bashir was invited to speak at the banquet of the Asian American Journalists Association. Bashir remarked about how exciting it was for him to be in a room full of great-looking, quote, Asian babes, end quote. And he added he was glad he was standing behind a podium so no one could see how excited he really was. Says Jeffrey Schneider, senior VP of ABC News, this kind of remark has no place in any setting, and Martin knows that and is truly sorry for his serious error in judgment. And Bashir says, I want to write and apologize for the inappropriate remark. Upon reflection, it was a tasteless remark that I now bitterly regret. Martin Bashir, ladies and gentlemen. John McCain has apologized for voting against the enactment of a federal holiday honoring the birthday of Martin Luther King Jr. in 1983. I was wrong, he said this week to applause in Orlando, Florida. The Brazilian man accused of murdering and dismembering a British girl has apologized to her mother. Now, listen to this name. Mohamed Dali Carvalho dos Santos was charged with killing 17-year-old Kara Burke after a torso, blah, blah, blah. You know, I don't do crime news. After a four-hour police interview in which Santos reportedly confessed to the crime, he was asked by a British reporter if he had anything to say to the girl's mother. He replied in English, tell her I'm sorry. I did not know what I was doing. He confessed he's not fully responsible for his acts, says his lawyer, because he was taking drugs nonstop during the 4 days prior to the killing. Well, let me see the twist marks on his arm. U.S. Ambassador to Iraq Ryan Crocker has formally apologized to the governor of Saladin, Hamad al-Qaisi, for the killing of his son by U.S. troops. He had threatened to avenge the killing of his son, vowing unspecified measures against U.S. troops. Uh-oh, duck. Some bishops of the Episcopal Church in the U.S. have apologized to bishops with more conservative views on homosexuality, saying they had no idea their church's consecration of a gay bishop in New Hampshire had caused such a negative impact in many parts of the communion. The apologies were extended this week as bishops discussed the issue, which has caused bitter conflict among Anglicans worldwide. And the state of Massachusetts has agreed to pay $100,000 to a man who was released from prison 4 years after his sentence should have ended. The Massachusetts Department of Correction has also apologized to Rommel Jones. Prison officials acknowledged last year that Jones and 13 other inmates had been confined after their sentences had ended. They promised to implement a new system for tracking sentences. Never too late. The apologies of the week, ladies and gentlemen, a copyrighted feature of this broadcast. Gentlemen, that concludes this edition of Le Show. The program returns next week at the same time over these same stations, over NPR worldwide throughout Europe on the USN 440 cable system in Japan, around the world through the facilities of the American Forces Network up and down the east coast of North America via the shortwave giant WBCQ, the planet, 7.415 megahertz shortwave, on the mighty 104 in Berlin, on the newly merged XM and Sirius satellite radio. Yeah, you'll pay less and you'll have more choice. Or see me. Available around the world via the internet at two different locations, live and archived whenever you want at harryshearer.com and kcrw.com. Available as a free download to members at www.audible.com/theshow and available as a free podcast at kcrw.com. And it'll be just like convicting the driver, if you would agree with me then. Thanks very much. Postscript to listeners in the San Francisco Bay Area, take the nice drive down to Los Gatos and join Judith Owen and myself for Jazz on the Plaz this Wednesday, early evening. Check the time. And if you're in the Seattle, Washington area, August 19th and 20th, I'll be appearing with my band, the High Value Detainees, performing songs of the Bushmen live at Jazz Alley. Check it out. Or ignore it. It's free country. The host of this broadcast, or find out what the music is, you can always go to harryshearer.com. And the video of the Karl Rove Classic Turd Blossom Special is available at mydamnchannel.com. The show comes to you from Century of Progress Production and originates through the facilities of KCRW Santa Monica, a community recognized around the world. It's the home of the homeless.